Hello and welcome to the Squawker Talker podcast. My name is Sam Long and I'm delighted to be joined by Squawker editor Will Hall.
Hiya, lovely to be here.
Good, good. And chief writer at Squawker, Mohammed Butt. How are you, Mo?
I'm feeling good, man. Feeling good. Ready to talk about some football.
Ready to roll. First up is Spurs ending their four-game Old Trafford losing streak by inflicting Jose Mourinho's worst ever home defeat at Man United. As usual, Mourinho grabbed the limelight after the game. And I'd like to know if you think he was right to say that United did not deserve to lose that game.
I mean, deserves a funny word, isn't it? Because it's like, in football, what is what is deserved to win a game? Is it because you create the most chances? Is it because, factually, you score the most goals? I think in terms of overall process, United played very well last night. In the first half, they should have been like 2-3 goals ahead. Second half, they weren't disastrously bad in attack. They created chances, they laid siege, sort of, to Hugo Reese's goal. Hugo Reese had a good game. So yeah, by those standards, yeah, you could argue, yeah, United deserve to win the game. But it's just hilarious hearing Mourinho talk like that, because Mourinho has always been, oh mate, who cares about deserve? You won the game, you won the game. And he gives it the whole big, you know, I win games. And then after that, he's talking like, technically, we deserve to win this game. And he's just like, are you Jose Mourinho? What's happened to you? He sounds like Wenger or Guardiola. And it's like, that's a perfectly normal thing to say, what Mourinho said after the match. Perfectly normal thing to say. But for him to say that is really baffling. It's really amazing. I mean, you know what? I think it's a touching tribute to Arsene Wenger. I think it's, you know, Wenger's retired and the Premier League had a gap in it for a manager who's passed it, won 3 Premier League titles and just, you know, babbled on about what he used to do and not what he does now. I think Mourinho stepped into that gap very nicely.
I think it's what he's begun to make a habit out of this sort of latter day Mourinho, though. I think this is nothing new. He has been for a couple of years now a manager who will just consistently shift values and just completely do an about turn on things he said. And it, obviously that feeds into this perception of him being someone who likes to play the media game, who just likes to say something and make the story about him and his comments, as opposed to his team's performances. But I think those two things now, him losing the plot and Manchester United collectively in terms of their performance, just you can see the anxiety draining like any kind of game intelligence. I think those two themes have become so intertwined now that he's lost that trick of being able to completely distract attention away from.
I mean, he did his best before the game as well, didn't he, with the
press conference, the arriving 35 minutes early, answering, putting questions in like 4 minutes, then going, yeah.
He's you know, how do you say this? It? Obviously, you know, it's easy to blame Ed Woodward for not signing him the players he wanted and everything. But last week, Eric Bailly didn't play well at Brighton, right? But Eric Bailly played well in the opening game against Leicester and plays well at Old Trafford generally. So why was he the one dropped altogether? And then Mourinho ducked questions about his fitness afterwards, because obviously he's not injured. He's just been dropped again, like last season. Why is Mourinho doing this to his most naturally talented defender? Obviously, Bailly is not a complete article. He's only had very little experience before he joined United. But he's clearly, out of all the five defenders, including Rojo, available to Mourinho, he's by far the best. Like, it's not even close. His capacity for greatness is much higher than anyone else. He ostracizes Bailly. Brings in Jones, who never, ever is reliable. And was awful last night. Should have given away a penalty in the first half.
Yeah, very fortunate not to.
You know, completely done by Harry Kane for the goal. I mean, and then on the second goal, out of position, doesn't do anything, and then doesn't even make an attempt to intercept the cross or intercept Lucas scoring the goal. Then by the grace of good, had the good grace to get injured and get taken off, so he couldn't cause United even further drama. You know, Lindelof was not, that back pass wasn't good, but overall he was whatever. But Smalling was having a good game and then got absolutely just like, he literally just fell over at Lucas Moura's feet. And it's like, what are you doing? That's not how you defend. And so he ruined his decent game by doing that. You know, I mean, yes, obviously it was clear as day, especially with Alderweireld playing so well at the other end, that United should have signed Toby Alderweireld, right? Or a centre-half. Harry Maguire scores a wonder goal at the weekend, plays very well. You know, these two guys, are they really not better than anyone United has? Come on, Ed. No one believes that.
I think these individual mistakes, they give the supporters of Mourinho a sort of argument as to say, well, what can the manager do about that? Mm. But one thing that just occurred when we talk about Eric Bailly is this willingness to just drop players after a single bad game, that can't be conducive of a clear head when the pressure's on and the game is not going well. Because, I mean, Man United are a team filled with technically gifted players, from people like Pogba to Juan Mata. But how many times did we just see Pogba sort of caught in possession under, admittedly, a very aggressively pressing Spurs team? And I think, not just against Spurs, but I'm talking across the last two performances against Brighton as well, there was like at least two or three occasions in which he just passed the ball out of play.
Yeah.
Like, and that's, this is like sort of lower league schoolboy level of just absolutely putting no thought. It's like, it reminds you of the Rooney performance against Iceland for England. Like that sort of, oh God, me. this is our worst nightmare.
Yeah, in both instances. In both instances, he was holding the ball, like waiting for someone to run in front of him to make a pass. And literally everyone was just standing still. It was so weird, especially against Spurs last night. He was holding the ball up and it's clear that Spurs have got him penned, right? So he can't dribble away from them, doesn't want to give the ball away. And he's like standing there like, come on, someone make a run so I can pass you the ball. And there's a massive space in front of him ready for someone to make a run. And no one makes a run. He's just there. It's like, and so eventually he just passes the ball out of play. He's like, well, okay, if you're not going to make a run, I'm just going to give the ball away in as safe as possible for a throw-in. It was just absurd. The tactical coherence is just non-existent with United. I mean, and even he played this 3-5-2, which, I mean, United have been playing 3-5-2 all season. That was their best system in pre-season, so glad he finally turned to that. But why is Ander Herrera in defence instead of... You know, and it was, I mentioned this in my article, it was like he was trying to sort of almost replicate the 2-2-4-2 that he used to mark to beat Chelsea in 2016-17. Very, very good defensive formation where Ander Herrera and Mateo Darmian were loosely in defence or in midfield, but really were just man-marking Eden Hazard and Pedro. And I don't know if he set his system up that way to counteract what he thought was going to be a 3-4-2-1 from Spurs, but in the end, because he picked Herrera and he didn't have a second man marker, there was no Darmian, there was Matic just playing a normal midfield role. The midfield didn't move the ball fast enough when they got it, because Matic doesn't move the ball fast enough. Matic was a lightning rod for Spurs' pressing, which they won the ball of him a couple of times. And more importantly than that, because it was just Ander Herrera doing a quote-unquote man-marking job, the shape just became 3-5-2 and he just played in defence instead of actually marking anyone in particular. He wasn't marking Dele like he did in the FA Cup semi-final. He was just there in defence. And it was like, and that's why United conceded the third goal, because he's 10 yards deeper than all his teammates, because he's a midfielder, doesn't know how to play offside. It's just, you know, it's like throwing things at a wall and seeing whatever sticks, and that's what he's going to go with. Mourinho has lost so much focus and so much discipline. There's no coherence, there's no idea, there's no strategy behind what he's doing. He's just trying things, hoping that it sticks. It's so much desperate flailing that, I mean, I'm genuinely amazed he's still in the job. I thought, honestly, after that display and after the Brighton display, and after all summer arguing with Will, but it's quite clear that he's not the man for the job. I'm honestly surprised I haven't sacked him this morning, because he's not going to get better. Things are not going to get better. They're going to get worse. And I don't know. He needs to go.
I think there is something to be said, though, for the first half performance being reasonably... Like, I mean, you could make the case that that's their best performance of the season. The problem, they created 17 chances, which is like at least 10 more than they've created in any other game. The problem is they've set the bar very low through those previous performances. And as we've said earlier, this is not like the value system that Mourinho espouses of just like results come first. This is, he doesn't have, we've said this previously, he doesn't have that excuse to fall back on. It's like a system that they're trying to implement that makes it okay for a good performance. And a good performance can represent progression in that sense. But you don't get that sense with Mourinho. You get the sense that next game is going to try something completely different. And then any good work that might have come from the creativity that was, I mean, to an extent on display in the first half, I would also say that that was a very hectic half in which passes were just going everywhere from both teams. Yeah, I mean, there's no indication that he's going to stick with the sort of system he's installed in that game.
Yeah, I mean, the style. Just the final thing on United, I would say if United stick with 3-5-2 and actually bring Eric Bailly and probably Marcus Rojo in to play at the wide defensive positions and Smalling or Lindelof or whoever in the middle, I think, you know, United could be pretty good. Rojo is at his best by far playing a left centre back in a back three. Bailly is a great defender, can have rough games, but basically is a good defender. You put them in the back three, playing that system, playing that attacking kind of football that United were playing at Spurs. It will come together eventually. United will start winning games. I don't necessarily think it's going to happen under Mourinho. Like Will says, God knows what he'll do next game. You just can't tell.
So as bad as it was for Man United, it was obviously a very good night for Spurs. So do we think that they'll feel like their title credentials have been enhanced with this win? Their odds have actually come into around the sort of 10s, 12s mark after last night. So the bookies obviously think that there's a bit, a glimmer of hope.
They'll feel more confident, but we have to remember two things. One thing is United were pitiful. And it was like, as much as Spurs were good and, well, not even really good. I mean, that's the thing, we'll hit that. You know, the first half United were good, but it wasn't good football. It was just two teams crashing into each other and United were getting the better out of it. And the second half, again, apart from the goal for the second goal, it wasn't really like Spurs suddenly started playing good football. They got a corner. Phil Jones is useless, so Harry Kane had a free header. It was still a great header, mind you, that he pulled off. And that was it, 1-0. And it was like, that was against the run of play, and you're like, okay. And then they scored a very good second goal, taking advantage of United's weaknesses. And okay, 2-0. But then they were just then sitting back. It wasn't like... It's a historic win for Spurs. First time they won at Old Trafford biggest ever win at Old Trafford for 46 years.
It's like 1972.
Yeah, it's a very, very momentous night and they can build on this. But in terms of the performance itself, we shouldn't get carried away. They didn't really play well. United were just objectionably bad and made it easy for them. Can they build on this? Again, in the short term, absolutely. In the medium term, even true. But this is the thing with Spurs. Has never been their first 11 has always been good enough to mount a title challenge. The problem is it's just their first 11. If they get any injury to anyone, the only depth they have right now, if you look at the people that aren't playing, are Son and Wanyama. And Wanyama apparently has been injured for like the last year. So I don't know what good he's going to be. I mean, he's better than Dier if he can come in and play. And then Davinson Sanchez and, you know, Ben Davis.
But you mentioned the sort of...
And then Son, sorry, to come back as well.
The question never really being about what's sort of the strength and depth that they have.
Yeah.
But I think what's significant for me is the fact that Dembele had a good game yesterday.
Yeah.
Alderweireld came back in. Lucas Moura looks like he's sort of at it. So it's the existing players that they have are coming good.
Oh, yeah,
so
yeah.
If they do have their starting 11 fit for this season, then they are going
to
be...
Oh, yeah, but they've got to keep them fit. And they've got to also play in the Champions League. They've got two major competitions to play in, and they've only really got, like, what you would call maybe 12 or 14 attacking players worth of damn. That is a recipe for disaster in the long term. I think they'll start the season very well, but I wouldn't be surprised to see them fall off a little bit towards the season's end. Not because they're not good. They're brilliant. They're a fantastic team. If they did a Chelsea and somehow managed to drop out of the Champions League... and drop out of the cups in for early rounds, they could win the Premier League. If they were just playing Premier League, they could definitely challenge City. But they're not. They have to play three other competitions. And I think that will take its toll, especially if they go far in either of them.
I definitely see that argument's still relevant, but I kind of feel like Spurs have sort of put that argument to bed in the last few seasons.
Yeah,
that they've proved that they don't have strength and depth, but they're still there or thereabouts. Because how many seasons have we been saying they've only got Harry Kane up front? Yeah, they've only got Harry Kane up front, but I don't see the problem with that.
I think the Lucas Moura performance is like tremendously encouraging. In fact, there's a nice parallel there to be drawn between him and Alex Sanchez. They're two attacking players, came in January. One has been successfully integrated to the extent that they're putting in sort of match-winning displays in big games. The other is sort of looks like he's completely disconnected from the rest of the team. So there are these little glimpses of class and technical ability, but they just seem, the problem is they're completely out of step with what the rest of the team is doing. And then you look at the summer, both teams had disappointing summers. Obviously Man United were more active than Spurs, which is, I mean, true of basically any team. but did overall have a disappointing transfer window by Mourinho standards. And yet, Pochettino's reaping the rewards of his work and the work he's put in and the ability to develop players. That's the thing with Mourinho. You can look at his signings. Like Lindelof was his number one defensive transfer target that summer, and he's just not. He's been there for a whole year now, and just as Jamie Carragher said, doesn't look up to this level.
Which is absurd, because if you watch him for Sweden, he looks brilliant. It's
exactly. Like, how good was he at the World Cup?
Exactly.
But, I mean, that is also true of Pogba. So
if the
case is mounting against Mourinho's ability to develop these players.
I thought it was interesting, quite telling actually, that the two players who Mourinho has truly developed, right, are Jesse Lingard and Romelu Lukaku. Everyone else has really either stayed the same or gotten worse under his charge. And I thought it was interesting last night, because Lingard was really good, and Lukaku missed the chance that basically would have probably tilted the entire game in United's favour.
That was reminiscent of the Alexis Sanchez miss as well, would you not say, against Newcastle. I think it was Newcastle last season at St. James's Park, where it was just like the screenshots going around on social media of like, how has he missed from here?
Yeah.
Like, retweet if your main striker could score.
It wasn't an easy chance as it looks in slow motion on the replays with the screenshots, like Will says, because he's running fast, he's off balance, and he's just come around the goalie. The angle isn't exactly open, it's a fairly narrow angle, and he's on his weak foot, right? So all the things combined against it wasn't like the worst miss in the world, but it's the kind of thing where Lukaku, being the kind of player Lukaku is, the kind of guy we know Lukaku can be, he should be scoring that goal. Yeah.
Just to come back to Spurs though, because we tentatively took one step in the direction of talking about Spurs, and then obviously because the Man United story is just irresistible in terms of being a journalist, but I think that's a huge step. I think, in fact, Pochettino previously made comments in February about this one hang-up that they have, which is their inability to go away to top six rivals and pick up points. I think he's won one game in his tenure. Before last night, he'd won one game away. I think it was against Manchester City. The other results are like ending mostly defeats, draws, that kind of thing. And he said he suggested this might be why they've been unable to win the title. We'll have to wait and see. Because in terms of whether they can, consolidate this as a step forward and just put in a big performance and then win their next big game away. But I mean, I think it's a huge hurdle. And if that is the missing ingredient in why they've not been able to win a title, then I mean, I think you only need to pick up like two wins probably, and then more draws than defeats away, and then you put yourself in a good position. And of course, three wins in three games, 100% start, one of the four teams to do so. So they're bang up there. They've got that to hang their hat. They've not been playing very well, but it's just a case of whether, I mean, this could go two ways. Either their level of performance will sort of catch up with them and they'll start dropping points, or they'll raise their level of performance to match those results and just keep winning and winning and winning. We've seen from Spurs that they can be quite a streaky team. My perception of them is that they do typically tend to start quite slow, as they have this season. The difference is they've not dropped any points. So if they go on their sort of annual sort of point surge at this point in the season, then tail off a little bit in the end, and then from recollection they appear to sort of end the season quite well, this foundation of points that they've just established in the first part of the season when they aren't playing well, I think that could be like the missing what they have been missing in terms of winning the title. I think overall it makes them a dangerous proposition in the title race for sure.
Let's wait and see. I mean, tactically they're doing interesting things. They played more of a diamond at the end of last game, pushing Lucas Moura really far forward, using his pace to sort of make up for the fact that Harry Kane hasn't got any pace, and it makes them more dangerous on the counter attack.
Whoa.
I love Harry Kane, but come on, if there's one thing he doesn't have, it's pace. So it's, you know, now they've got Lucas Moura running in behind, making full work Chris Smalling and that. Now they're going to be dangerous in late game situations. It's just, I remain concerned about their squad in terms of the ability to actually impact a long 38 game season as competing on multiple fronts. They could finish third, solid third, maybe even second, but let's just wait and see. Their squad is very thin.
I just feel like we disagree on that. I feel like they've always
their
had
squad is thin, but Pochettino likes to work with a small squad.
Yeah, lots of managers do as well. Like Jose Mourinho is the same. I mean, it's good to have a obviously the drawback is that if a player gets injured, then it hurts a lot more, but at least you can depend on, you know what you've got to work with.
So moving on, Liverpool edged past Brighton and climbed above Man City into first place after Pep's men were forced to rescue a point at Wolves. So do we think the champions were unlucky or complacent in their draw at Molineux?
They were very unlucky. They had two penalties, a reasonable penalty if he was turned down. They hit the Wilbert three times. Bossed the game. City are playing magnificently. Wolves played very well, dug their heels in and got a result, you know, that they needed. Vincent Kompany was terrible, and I think if Guardiola's learned his lessons, learned anything from this game, is that he can't play Vincent Kompany again in a game where only at home against weak teams, not anywhere. And even then, I would just keep him. I would just use him as a cheerleader. Honestly, he looks absolutely finished. He's always been a very aggressive defender to come up, push up very hard, and make big tackles, and that's always worked very well for him because he's had the physical capability to push up, make a tackle, then run back and get in position. Now against Wolves, he was pushing up, making a tackle, sometimes not making the tackle because he's just not that good anymore, and then being way out of position, and then Wolves were just running into the spaces where he wasn't. And you know, it was just Laporte was playing his heart out, but poor guy was just like completely and utterly overworked because Kompany was just not good. And I mean, that's where Wolves got their goal from. And you know, Wolves deserved a draw because they played very well. But at the same time, if City had won that game, you wouldn't have been like, oh, lucky City. They were much the better side. And they were also unlucky. You know, they didn't... Aguero hitting the woodwork with that shot, with that first-time shot just after Wolves scored was like, oof, that was unlucky. So, yeah, City are very, very good. They drew against Everton at the start of last season, if you recall. It was very sort of underwhelming when Rooney scored that goal, and it was like, ooh, but they just kicked on. They were playing well in that game. They're playing well against Wolves. Yeah, they'll be fine.
Away at Wolves, though, I'd say that it's perhaps the game that champions would find the way to win there.
Well, you know, again, two penalties turned down, hit the woodwork three times, and yet 9 times out of 10, they win that game.
Yeah, I mean, you consider how bad Everton were at the start of last season. Yeah. And as Mo said, they drew there. I kind of completely forgot about how sort of staggered their start was last season. I assumed it was just like this sort of
blitz.
Yeah, exactly. Like steamrolled the league. But yeah. So my initial thoughts was, oh, well, that could drain some of the fear factor away. But yeah, if you look at the complexion of their title run last season, then it's something they've shown they can recover from. Basically,
it's definitely, without offending any City fans out there, good to see them drop points early because it's sort of been built
as
they are going to run away with it, they are going to smash everyone again. But I think it's sort of been glossed over a bit of how difficult it is to actually defend the title.
Oh yeah, no, I never thought they were going to run away with it. It's so, like, the only people that have defended the Premier League title are Jose Mourinho and Sir Alex Ferguson. Mourinho did it over a decade ago. Ferguson did it more recently, 2009, but even then, 2009, that's a decade ago, literally. So it's like, no one, you know, Mourinho lost it in 2006, Ferguson lost it in 2009, no one's done it since then. It's not easy to defend the title, it's very hard. It's a physically demanding league, it's a mentally intensive league, and, you know, to go again is not easy. It's really not easy. And City are probably the best placed team to go again because they're the best team and they have the best coach. But it's not going to be as easy as last season, especially now that they've lost De Bruyne for 3 months. I mean, you know, and back to what you said about it's good to see them drop points. It is, in a way, important that they, for other teams, that they drop points now with De Bruyne out injured. Because had they just gone on like won like 3-4 games with De Bruyne out injured, then we'd be like, ugh. So not even that can take them out of stride.
Yeah.
But, you know, and again, it was weird because obviously I thought they played just fine and they could have won. They would have won the game 9 times out of 10, even though De Bruyne wasn't there. But it was almost maybe important for opponents to sort of see that, oh, look, they're mortal now. They don't have De Bruyne. I don't think that's the case. I think they'll probably win the next game and win the next few games and get back on track. But there were things needed correcting in City. I mean, mainly just Kompany. And I mean, now let's see if Guardiola's learned that lesson.
I think the Willy Bolly goal as well is a tough pill to swallow.
Yeah.
Certainly. And I think like this, the VAR thing, it's the unexpected side effect of it. It's brought a tremendous amount of scrutiny on this handball rule and like what is intentional handballing. And yeah, and I think I'd definitely be annoyed with that as a City fan. And then even more so when people like Keith Hackett are tweeting that, well, actually, because it's not an intentional movement toward the ball, the goal should have still stood even if
I mean, yeah, you look at, I mean, we'll get onto La Liga in later just briefly, but if you look at, I mean, like Barcelona winning 1-0 against Villarreal, Valladolid scored a 91st minute goal, which is offside, but previous years that stands, and you know, and Barca go with a draw, but because VAR's there, VAR's like, no, he's offside, and then it's like, oh, Barca get the win. So it can, literally, and the last 16-17 title, Barca didn't win that title because... a draw against Real Betis. No, I'm just saying one game.
How have we got here?
one game can impact. It's VAR is so important. There were like three or four decisions over the course of the weekend, and you're watching it. You're like, VAR would sort that out. And one decision can honestly impact either a relegation battle or a title race.
Right, but the point is that the Hackett theory.
Yeah, but that's
the goal would have still stood.
I don't think
and we
so.
Also saw like in the Bundesliga this weekend that Ribéry dive in the penalty against Hoffenheim completely changed the game. And that was VAR didn't save the day there.
I feel like we're opening up a VAR can of worms here.
As VAR is apt to do.
So moving back to Premier League, obviously Liverpool have gone top.
Yeah.
How significant do we think it is for them to sort of get their noses in front? Do you think they're going to sort of aim... Well, do you think it would suit them to lead from the front, or are they going to be better as a sort of chasing team?
I mean, I don't think it actually is significant in terms of them going top, but I think to Liverpool it probably really is. That sounds weird to say, but I think if you look at it, you're thinking three games into the season, who cares if you're top? Like, it doesn't make a difference. But I think to Liverpool, it must be like, hey, we're top. Let's go. You know, because Klopp's teams are so built on confidence, built on momentum, and they're just moving forward. Like, they weren't good against Palace, but they got the win. They gutted it out anyway. Yeah. You know, they weren't really good against Brighton, but they gutted the win out anyway. They got there. You know, and I think it's just like it's kind of like what you said about Spurs. It's like they're not really playing well, but they're winning anyway, and that's. Once they start playing well, holy, good God, duck and cover, man. Because, when Liverpool start rolling, it's like, get out of the way. So it's like, the fact that they've won 3 out of 3 and they haven't even played well yet, it's like, oh God.
It's definitely one of the things where if you are the team that is in first place, it's significant. If you're not, it's only 3 games into the season.
Yeah.
I think to expand on your point there, they've not been playing well. Past 2 games, I genuinely feel like... they've relied somewhat on the fear factor they've developed.
Yeah.
In that we saw they start the game really strongly, create chance after chance, and just like pummeling the opposition. Score once, and then we get this sort of weird section of the game where it all quiets down a little bit. And then the opposition, who have previously been giving Liverpool perhaps too much respect, start to come at them. And we saw that made for quite an uncomfortable Monday night in the Palace game.
Yeah.
In the Brighton game, that late header from Pascal Gross, I mean, that nearly clinched a point.
Mm.
And this was at a point in the game where I don't know if it's a case of opponents who aren't expecting to be competing so high up the league are trying to manage the game in such a way that they just weather the storm for the first 45 minutes and then between the 50-minute and sort of 70-minute mark, then they really start to play. But as I said, I think... it's a case of maybe teams are going to figure them out at some stage, unless, like Mo says, they do get up and running and start to become the sort of swaggering Liverpool side we saw in like the Champions League late stages last season.
For that reason,
being top of the league can only add to that. I mean, you're sort of top dog, so you've got that aura of invincibility, which, I mean, as I said earlier.
No, I mean, I've always maintained that Liverpool aren't. Klopp is not set up to win a league title in a 38-game season with no extended winter break. You know, I just don't think his style is conducive to that. But momentum is a funny thing. Momentum is a very funny thing. In the NFL, for example, just a brief sporting digression, there's a thing, the teams that win their divisions, right? They get a bye, they get a week off, and then they come to the second round. And that teams that get wildcard spots have to go and play in the wildcard weekend, and it's an extra game. And the theory is obviously, oh, it's better to get a bye, yeah, sure. But often what you'll find is the team that plays in that wildcard weekend has momentum, and they carry that forward into the next game against the team that had a bye. And the fatigue factor is sometimes it's the thing, but often it's not a thing. It's like momentum is so important. I think
it's the same with the playoffs, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and you look at Liverpool, and... they're such, you know, they're obviously there's an element of if teams start just sitting deep and defending deep against them, we can see they'll give them trouble again. You know, they'll cause them more problems, and Liverpool have to find out solutions to break them down. But I mean, there's so, and I think the fear of, Will was actually right. A lot of what makes great teams great is the fact that before you even get on the pitch against them, you're terrified, you're beating yourself, you've already conceded a goal. And Mane, Firmino, and Salah are such a deadly trio. It's like, oh God, we're playing them again. And it's like almost like you've almost gone 1-0 down before you even got on the field. And then it's like, and you know, you panic and stuff, and you get anywhere. If Firmino gets in your box, you start getting worried. Salah comes anywhere near, you don't want to let him shoot because anything he shoots goes in. It's, so Liverpool have a myriad of psychological factors playing in their favour anyway. I think if you're being very objective, I think you'd think, again, physical, sheer fatigue will catch up with them. But at the same time, if they build up enough momentum, if they win like three or four games, if they win like four or five games, right, they win a couple more games and they haven't really played well, and then they start to play well, even if teams are coming at them like, okay, we're going to take Liverpool down, you know, think what Liverpool almost want is teams to come at them, because then it opens up space in behind for them to counter into. What Liverpool don't want is teams to be like, oh, okay, these teams are really good, let's just sit back and count, like they do against City all the time. City just face constant deep blocks. If Liverpool start getting that treatment, they could be in trouble. So it's almost better for Liverpool to constantly look kind of wary and rubbish and not really at it, because then teams are like, okay, we can take these, and then come out, and then Liverpool suddenly have loads of space to move into behind, and then it's like, then they're really causing trouble, then they're really having fun.
That defence is looking very settled as well.
Alisson is settled in very quickly.
Gomez, and the fullback pairing is potentially the best in the league right now. They're creating chances for each other.
Joe Gomez is the one. For me, Joe Gomez is the one. It's obviously Alexander Arnold very good. Not the best defensively.
That Benjamin was
beautiful. It was
Tavares
beautiful.
Slice.
look, Robertson is like the ultimate. Like he's like a left foot. He's like a left footed Gary Neville. Just ultimate 7 out of 10 every single game. Works his absolute socks off for the team. Isn't a miraculous super player, but doesn't have to be. Just constantly gets up and down, does his job. Alexander Arnold, not a great defender, but very, very good with the ball at his feet. Very, very offers a lot of attacking options down that side. That, like Will says, that pass was just sublime. But Joe Gomez is the one for me. Because Lovren had a good season last year, but it was a surprise. And you're sort of thinking, really? And there's all you always. He was good, but he was never, I would never say he was like really, like to the point where you're like, oh, this guy's amazing. There were a couple of games where
one of the best defenders in the world.
Well, yeah, exactly. But Joe Gomez, I think, I mean, I know he's very young, but Joe Gomez has enormous potential because he is just such a really, really solid, no-nonsense defender. He's the perfect partner for Van Dijk in many ways because, I mean, he's not tall, but Van Dijk is a very sort of elegant, controlling centre-back. But, you know, Gomez is sort of very no-nonsense. Which you wouldn't assume so, but he just gets rid of the ball. He just does his job defensively. He's very. I suppose the one comparison. I don't want to get too carried away, but he reminds me of Raphael Varane in the sense that he just does his job defensively. Obviously, he's not that level. Varane has been that level since he was 19, but Gomez just does his job. Nothing flashy. Nothing. The defensive partner always gets to shine. But Gomez to me is the game. Like, I really hope he keeps his place once Lovren comes back because. To me, Liverpool looks so much better with him in there. He seems to he just gets it, man. He just knows how to just be solid and be a complementary piece to Van Dijk. Van Dijk and Alexander Arnold are the two that stand out. They're the showmen in the back four. Robertson and Gomez are very sort of like stable and solid. And it just works. It's really the one weakness we'll have, as always, is they don't have a defensive midfielder, and a team that plays in between the lines is going to hurt them. But That's their only weakness, and maybe that'll get fixed once they get Fabinho up to speed anyway. So
elsewhere, another one of the top teams, Chelsea, scraped a 2-1 win over negative Newcastle thanks to a late DeAndre Yedlin own goal. I'd like to know if you think that results are masking performances for Chelsea, or should we consider the Blues genuine title contenders?
It's a process, isn't it, with Sadi? This is what we always know. Sadismo is you can't go from Conte to Sadi and immediately. But they're getting it. Their things are improving. You can see Jorginho's breaking passing records left, right and centre. Chelsea, against Newcastle, Chelsea had, played 1,098 passes, which is over 100 more than any other Premier League team has managed in a game. Sorry, that was touches. They had 913 passes, which also is 100 more than any other team managed in a Premier League game season. They're very, very good. They're getting it. They're really understanding it. It's not there yet. Title contenders, I mean, it's about momentum, isn't it? You wouldn't say you think they're going to, like Sadi even himself said, I'm going to make mistakes. There's going to be hardships. Let's not get carried away. They've gotten lucky so far. They were very lucky against Newcastle. Very lucky against Newcastle. But no, I think even more so than Liverpool, their luck will run out, and their luck will run out very soon. And I suspect they'll drop points here and there. But the potential for them, this is what I think. If you're a Chelsea fan, you should be looking at next season, because potentially, once Hazard is fully ingratiated, and he's not fully into this system yet, he's running all over the place, not really getting it. But once Hazard is fully into this system and he's bought in, and once Jorginho is even better settled, and once Kante is even better settled, Chelsea could be terrifyingly good.
Of course, there's a risk though with Hazard.
That's the other thing. You've got to win something this season, otherwise he's going to like toodles and go to Real Madrid. So I don't know. But look, I think Chelsea have looked very good. Chelsea haven't looked very good. But the fact that they're picking up wins anyway is always a good sign. But they were very lucky against Newcastle. Newcastle was so hard done by.
Yeah, I think we've basically said about all of those teams that have picked up title points that there are improvements to be made. So they're not a rare exception. I mean, the Kante role appeared to come under question. I think Ruud Gullit sort of questioned the wisdom of playing him so advanced forward, but I think that's going to happen in a game where you're playing against such a low block who don't want possession, is that Kante in that advanced role isn't going to be able to press and harry to the same extent.
Well, yeah, exactly. If no one's coming out to play, then what's he doing?
So, yes, certainly an element of luck in that result.
That brings me on to my next point about Rafa Benitez's tactics. He's obviously got a lot of criticism. So do you think his tactics are indefensible, or can you kind of understand why
What is that about? Like, as if Sean Dyche didn't finish seventh and have everyone singing his praises for playing exactly that kind of football last season. What is this nonsense? No. Rafa Benitez was brilliant. It's a tactical masterstroke against Chelsea. He didn't play 4-4-1-1, didn't pack the midfield like standard thing, two banks of four, blah, 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 nonsense. He actually played 5-4-1 very deliberately, because 5-4-1 is the best counter to a passing team playing 4-3-3, because you can go man for man almost at the back. You can have your two full-backs mark the wingers, and you can have one of your centre-backs mark the forward. And then obviously you never want to have two free men, but when you're playing a passing side, it's always good to have two free men, because then one of your centre backs can go wide to help your winger out against overloads out there, and width is the best way to break down the defensive side. So if you've got five men at the back, it's much harder to break them down the wings, which Chelsea couldn't do. They struggled to do that. Got a very soft penalty which broke the system apart, and then Rafa Benitez abandoned it, took off Shah, brought on Muto as they chased a goal, and they got a goal, and it was amazing. But once you've done that, it's very hard to then suddenly retreat back into this defensive shell, especially as you don't have Shah on the pitch, who's probably your best defender. So no, Rafa Benitez did look, like I said, I remember they had 100 more passes than anyone else, not 100 more touches than everyone else. They had 15 shots of goal, which isn't a massive number of shots, and they had zero big chances created. Chelsea created no big chances despite all their possession, all their touches, all their control of the game. So from a Newcastle perspective, Rafa Benitez did a damn good job. They just got unlucky with a very soft pen against them, and that broke open the game. You know, you can't legislate for that.
I think the criticism is going to come from the Sky studio, who will obviously have an agenda in that they would prefer to see entertaining football. I think the only people who would need to defend himself to are the fans, who by and large seem to be on board with what he's doing. I mean, the support is there of him among Newcastle supporters.
Definitely, yeah.
Can't be a great afternoon out going to watch that. It's expensive too. So, I mean, you have to... It might become an existential question as to whether is it worth just existing in the Premier League or...
I think that's what it kind of boils down to. If you were a Newcastle fan and you turned up to that game, one of the big boys are in town, and you sort of set up like that, it's... I mean, if they had got the result, then he deserves to have his praises sung. But when you set up like that and it doesn't come off, then it's almost like you don't really have anywhere to go because you've given the initiative to the opponents for the whole game.
Yeah, well, that's the flaw with results-based football. It's like you're chasing a result. It's like if you don't get it, then what was even the point? But, you know, Newcastle's, they're underfunded. You know, they don't get the money they need to compete in the transfer market. Not really. Rondon I love Rondon, but it's a bargain basement pickup for a striker. They needed someone who can hold the ball up and score goals. You know, they didn't get that. They've got someone who can hold the ball up. I love Rondon, but, you know, let's be honest about what he is. I think... I think Newcastle, a couple of seasons, two seasons of stability in the Premier League, and I think maybe then you can start looking to be a bit more ambitious.
But is it going to... Are they going to have two seasons? Is Rafa Benitez going to stay there for two seasons? Or is it just going to be a managerial change?
No, I think he's had a... He's got a decent contract, doesn't he? And I think they've got to stick with him, surely.
But he's so frequently...
He is, but...
leaking briefing press that he's about to quit.
Well, yeah, because he's furious with the way that his Ashley... You know, Ashley's out here buying... What was it?
House of Fraser.
It's like, mate, give him 10 million for a striker, for God's sake. What's wrong with you?
I think so, yeah. So the only people who has to turn himself to are his employees, obviously, but then again, they've not exactly shown a huge amount of ambition themselves, as Mo has alluded to. Fans, we've spoken about. Players, that's the most pressing one. The reports that Jamal Lascelles was quite keen, wasn't happy with the role he was about to be asked to play. And then Rafa Benitez used a slight injury concern to leave him out of the squad altogether. He's his club captain. And
what was the role? That's what I want to know. Because he's a centre back. So what exactly was he complaining about?
I think there was some kind of it was to do with the back three. So he would rather play on the
on one side. He was going to play on the other side.
I think in the report I read, he was keen on playing the sweeper role.
Right, and everyone Benitez wanted someone else there. Okay, look, like Will says, if anything undoes him, it's going to be the players turning against him. I don't think the owners are going to turn against him just because I think it's a big hassle to sack him. And he is ultimately a very good coach. The fans seem to be behind him because they probably understand the fact that he's not getting supported by the board. So it's like, well, they'd rather see Mike Ashley go, I'm pretty sure, the fans. So it's just about whether the players turn on him or not. And I mean, like he's already had a little bit of a row with Jamal Lascelles, but... I don't know.
Alleged rap.
Look, I hope he stays. I like Rafa Benitez a lot, and I think much more so than Jose Mourinho, he's adapted to the changing world of football. Those two were the kings of football before Guardiola's revolution in 2008, but Benitez has adapted by moving further down the league and just realising that, okay, look, I'm not going to manage at the elite level of the game anymore because that's not my style of football, but I'm going to go with this mid-table team.
Mourinho was never going to do that.
No, Mourinho's not going to do that, but my point is, you know, he hasn't changed his ways. Benitez is like, okay, well, elite level football looks like that. No, okay, fine. I'm going to go here, chill in the mid-table and make some people love me. And, you know, I think Newcastle would be foolish to not back Rafa to the hilt here because I think he's doing very well. Yeah, with what he's been given, which is basically nothing, he's doing very well, and I think he'll continue to do very well. Shah's a quite clever pickup, by the way, as well. Watch out for that.
So elsewhere, Emery and Djukanovic both secured their first Premier League wins at the weekend against West Ham and Burnley, respectively. So I'd like to know, is this a double win for the philosophy versus pragmatism debate?
Yeah, well, I mean, at last, right? We've had so many, you know, actual good teams playing good football. This is what I've been saying.
He's been feeding Allardyce ammunition for his TalkSport rants.
Look, man, Fulham have been playing such good football this season. I've been saying this all game. I've been like, they're going to win at some point. It's going to turn around for them. And sure enough, Mitrovic scores two goals and it turns around for them. They beat Burnley. Smash them around, and it's beautiful because Fulham deserve it because Fulham have been playing. By the way, it's no coincidence that as soon as Fabry gets out of goal, they win a game. They've been playing very good football, Fulham. And this is finally the process coming good and being rewarded, and they've got rewarded with a victory, and it's a really huge victory because now it's like, okay, we can compete in the Premier League. We just beat the darlings of the Premier League, Burnley. Let's kick on now. Let's go forward and let's... Because once you get confidence into a passing team, into a possession team, it changes everything. Jean-Michel Seri scored his first goal. That's going to be huge for him.
Great goal as well.
Yeah, that was an absolute banger. And he's been really good. He's been really good. Mitrovic has been good. It's just... It's a really... It was not just a win. It was an impressive win. They played good football again and they actually got the result this time to back it up. So I just feel like that's game-changing for me.
Yeah, I definitely think that in terms of... Which was the greater victory for philosophy over pragmatism. It's Fulham's 22 chances they created, which was the joint most this week. As you said, Sarri looks amazing. The one caveat being that they're playing an exhausted Burnley side who appear very much there for the taking right now. But I think the biggest plus was those Mitrovic goals. Because we saw over the World Cup and at the beginning of this season is that his movement is sublime and he's very much able to create chance after chance after chance for himself. His weakness, his obvious weakness, is finishing.
He's European Cavani.
Fair.
I think Arsenal.
I think we're going to live and die by.
That's the thing. If you're a possession team, you need goals. Goals are the important. Goals are your currency that will keep you alive. And Mitrovic, that's why it's so important that he's now got three goals so far this season. That's very important. His goals are going to be huge. I mean, he was what powered them to their great run last season, wasn't it? So
I thought it was quite interesting as well that he didn't play Sessegnon, sort of taking him out the firing line almost.
I did wonder, you know, what's the step up to the Premier League going to be like for Sessegnon? I thought he was going to smash it, but it looks like it might be a bit more of an adaptation process than I thought.
I think also Fosu Mensah looked good. Yeah, he looked very good. He looked very much Man United were missing.
Yeah, I was going to say he recalled Bettinelli and Odoi as well, who were obviously key figures for them in the Championship, but then have sort of lost their places in the opening weeks of the season, so I thought that was quite interesting.
With their goalkeeping situation, once they get Sergio Rico adapted, that's it, it's game over. He's going to be their number one, and he's brilliant. So they go, as long as they get Fabry out of goal, because Fabry was a liability, he's the reason they didn't beat Everton, so you know it's good for them to get rid of him. But going on to Arsenal, you know, look, it's good they got a win, you know, but they didn't play well. They had good little spurts of domination, but you know they needed some helping hand, you know, to get over the line. And it's just like, oh,
it's interesting. I think like stylistically you can see there's a bit more zing in attack. It's not like little cute passes in that very easy on the eye style that Wenger was famous for. It's a bit more like sort of run it, like knock the ball, run, play the pass at just the right time. It's a bit more like a fast break that takes place in the final third. But stylistically, yeah, they look very different. But on the other hand, in terms of like how games tend to unfold, it's very, very, very reminiscent of the Arsenal we saw previously, where they have periods in which they look very ropey, periods in which they massively turn it on. This time West Ham were equally ropey in defence and they were able to...
It's just very typical early season Unai Emery. He's not really figured out his best team yet. He's not giving his best striker Lacazette enough burn yet. They'll bring it on and they'll be better. Sorry, they'll bring Lacazette on into the fold and he'll be and they'll be better as a result once he figures it all out. Second half of the season, Arsenal will be very good. First half, maybe a bit dodgy.
When he patches things up with Mesut Özil as well.
Well, yeah, that's
it. Sickly Mesut. Catching too many colds, I think, of Mesut. So finally, I just wanted to get both your thoughts on the pitch at Real Valladolid. How bad was it?
Oh, it was atrocious. Absolutely horrific. They've had since mid-June to relay the thing and they waited until 3 days before they're playing Barcelona at home. I mean, I don't know if they did that deliberately or if they just completely forgot about it, but it was absolutely atrocious. The thing was digging up. It was like ridiculous. There's actually one picture of Jordi Alba lifting up the pitch to look under it. It's like, I mean, obviously that's great meme potential, first of all, but as a pitch to play on, it's horrific. I'm honestly surprised Barca got out of there with no injuries. I mean, really, just quite miraculous. But I would actually watch out because... over the next couple of weeks, see if any Barca players pick up muscle injuries, because it wouldn't surprise me if that happened. Because I remember in 2012-13 they played Argentina played in La Paz, and Messi and Mascherano were the only two Argentina players that didn't get rotated. They played 90 minutes in La Paz, they were exhausted, and then over the next 2 weeks both of them suffered season ending muscle injuries, and I really wonder if that's going to happen again, because playing on that pitch is energy sapping. It's just destroys your legs. You can't run. Messi couldn't dribble. It was the first time I've ever seen this. He couldn't dribble anyone. It was amazing.
I think Piqué hits the nail on the head as well. Especially in the wake of this sort of this news that they've agreed a marketing deal that could potentially see them play a game in the US.
Yeah.
And then obviously Piqué said, well, before we think about the US, let's look to our own.
They're going to get fined, you know, via the lid, and that's good. But the fact that it was allowed to happen, like the thing again, since mid June they've played the last game mid June, so they could have laid this pitch at the end of June.
The compilation doing the rounds on Twitter as well is really something. I would advise all our listeners to check that out. It's just like balls bumping up over
it's
divots.
It's honestly absurd that it was allowed to play, and perhaps the only thing more ridiculous than that in the Spanish league is that Ronaldo, the real Ronaldo, is about to buy Valladolid. He must have saw that picture and thought, I'm going to piece
get
that.
A discount after that game.
The rumor is he's going to be pay 30 million and become their chair, become their president.
Isn't he still recovering from pneumonia?
Mate, obviously that picture has reinvigorated. Like, oh mate, pneumonia be damned. I need to own this club. He's like so upset with it. He's like, I must correct this. This will never happen under Ronaldo's watch. So you know, Ronaldo could be back in La Liga. Won't we lose one Ronaldo? Get another one.
So that's all we've got time for today. Thanks to our guests, Mo.
All right. Thank you very much.
And Will.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
And thanks to all the listeners. Catch you soon.